For the next episode of Dedington Discussions, Hilary Smith talks to Daniel Inman.
Hi, this is Hilary talking to Daniel Inman. It's November the 17th. Here we go. So, Daniel, thank you very much for being willing to come and talk to me.
My pleasure.
I gather that you've had quite an interesting weekend, that you've come from the hot coals experience.
Yes.
Have you survived all right?
I successfully navigated the 20 feet of burning embers along with 15 or 16 others. So that's, yes, that was great fun. And I think we've raised quite a bit for youth work in the village. And I was raising money for Barford's church roof, which is... the ceiling is crumbling somewhat. Yeah. So, but anyway, that was great fun and great to be part of.
What was the technique that you learned?
Well, we had to have sort of 2 hours prior to walking across the cold, so some motivational exercises, and which meant sort of getting very excited and telling ourselves we were magnificent and wonderful and powerful.
So it was mind over matter.
It was a bit of that, although that wasn't the reason that we were able to cross over the cold. You know, there's physics allows for that to happen. So
can you is that possible to explain?
Well,
the physics?
I'm not a no great scientist, but it's something to do with the material itself. It's wood, because the coals were wood pellets, I think, and wood's a very poor conductor of heat. So you can, as long as you move quickly enough, you don't hang around long enough for the heat to transfer to your foot. And there's a certain amount of moisture between your foot and the which will just go into steam.
I see.
If you move quickly enough.
Yes.
Which I did.
So you were pretty speeding.
Yes, we had to kind of charge ahead.
Were you pleased with what you managed to raise?
Yes, I think so. We haven't got the final total yet, but... I think that's being worked out at the moment, so it's more of a task of collecting it. So,
you managed to get a lot of people involved?
Yes, yeah. We had, so I think about 16, 17 people in the end. So, and lovely to see so many people out there on the night. It was really great to have that support and to see the community the present in that way. It was great, great fun. Yeah.
Good, well, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Do you often come up with little projects like this?
That wasn't my project at all. That was... Olivia Fenian, who is one of our church members, she's a great entrepreneur, and that's a very new form of raising money, but it's quite effective, I think.
Yes.
People haven't heard about walking on hot coals as a method of raising money. It's more like parachuting or abseiling down towers. So, great fun, and Olivia did a grand job. Definitely.
Oh, that's lovely. as assistant curate.
Yes.
How does that fit in?
Well, technically, the vicar is a curate as well. In the prayer book of the Church of England from the 16th century, you pray for bishops and curates. There are no vicars mentioned. And curate just means someone who has the cure of souls. When I'm ordained, I'm given the cure of souls of a group of people. And that's what curate means. And the vicar is the curate of the village. In that sense, it is his job. He's the incumbent of that post, and I assist him in that.
Yes.
So it's a training post, and I'm here for 3 to 4 years, learning the tricks of curing people's souls. Which aren't always immediately obvious, but it's like an apprenticeship.
Really. Understand.
So and just been here since July 2010.
Mm. What have been the things so far that you've learned that you maybe things you didn't intend or didn't?
Yes, I think you sort of learn new things every day in terms of the people you engage with and meet. I just kind of sat around in libraries for the years preceding this, and to go from that existence, which was very enjoyable, and I loved reading and writing. To the sort of life where you are, say working with kids, which I thought I'd be terrible at and hate, but actually have absolutely loved, because kids are so open-minded and fresh in their thinking, and don't have the same conceit, level of conceit as adults do, or awkwardness about questions of God or religion that a lot of adults do. So they'll come up with great questions, which really make me think more than the questions that I often get from parishioners.
Yes.
The kids will just go straight to the heart of the issue, and that's been very good for me, I think, for example. So we did an assembly last week, or a few weeks ago, where we've been taking the school through the Old Testament, which is lots of stories of blood and gore and violence, which they'd normally love. but one lad from year three stuck up his hand after we talked about the plagues against Egypt in Exodus, and just, you know, just asked, why is God killing everybody? Which is a very valid question, of course, in the Old Testament. And you know, you've got to provide an understandable answer which is satisfactory. Whether I did that, I don't know. But it's very invigorating and stimulating to be around that sort of thinking.
Yes, I can understand you're faced with, well, what do I mean by it before yes. you even can explain it in their language?
Yes, exactly, which is quite tough. You do want the answer. I don't think there's any obvious answer except that people learn about God across different centuries. So learn new things about him, and I suppose we learn most about him in Jesus. But something I said something like that. I think he looked just as puzzled. but it keeps coming up. So that's and you know, they have their qualms in asking questions like that, which is great. And
it's interesting because what you just said is that each age has to kind of interpret or reinvent.
Yes.
A meaningful way of looking at religion, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and. And of course, there are boundaries to that, which the tradition in which we are set as, which you know, I'm set as a priest, you know, there are boundaries to that reimagination, because you receive a body of knowledge and writing, which says God is like this. And then you've got to successfully convey that to an age which thinks completely differently about the world and the meaning of life. And of course, that creates all sorts of tensions and struggles, which you see across Christianity at the moment, especially in the Church of England, and even on the local level, you know, speaking to kids and making God meaningful for them, which you know, sometimes he is, sometimes he isn't. I don't know, but it's that's very stimulating, that sort of engagement and being on the ground, as opposed to thinking about it historically in, with books. So,
yes. Yes. Does that then involve parents sometimes? Does that draw people
in? Yes, sometimes. I mean, I suspect with a village, maybe we have a certain number of parents who come to our services. I suspect our services don't really provide the sort of space for engagement where you can answer back. Our traditional services are still pulpit-based and do not evoke responses from the floor, but perhaps they should. And I know the vicar tries that sometimes, but people don't like being asked questions, I think they've said before. So certainly it would be lovely to have that sort of engagement with adults.
Is that possible sometimes in a different kind of forum?
Yes, I think it is. I think it's more one-to-one, and it does happen around the parish, but not an awful lot. I don't know why that is, perhaps. People don't think the questions are worth asking anymore, which could well be the case. Religion isn't a meaningful aspect of many people's lives nowadays in the way it was 100 years ago. But the questions are definitely still there. I mean, they're not just questions about Christian doctrine. They're questions of, you know, why is there something rather than nothing, or why do we die, or you know, they're common to all of us. So I think the church should be a place where those questions can be asked freely and generously, without the feeling that either me as a Christian or any other person as a Christian is going to come back and say that's heretical. I think that's important to me in what a Christian community should be, especially the Church of England, I think, a parish church.
Yes.
And it is the village's church, I think. People feel our parish church is theirs. And it's not just for the Christian congregation which goes there, it's for the whole village. And so for it to be a space where people can come together and debate big questions, I mean, that's, I think they do in a way already, but
yes,
but it'd be nice if the church, the national church, could provide that sort of space, I
yes.
suppose. But we lack that sort of...
What do you think we gain by not saying you've got to be Church of England before you walk in this door? What does it bring, do you think, long term?
By not saying that.
By allowing it, actually.
Well, I think the Church of England has always been distinct by its national character. There's the common joke that Anglicans don't really believe anything, but that people come together, that's a space where they express their spiritual life. I don't think that's true of our congregation, I should add, at this point, nor of me. But what that sort of having that sort of conversation, I think, will rejuvenate the Church of England.
Mm.
The Church of England is incredibly inward looking in its behaviour and in its the issues which it's currently concerned with, and doesn't listen to everyday concerns.
Yes.
And actually the core questions are still there.
Yes.
And I don't know why we're not engaging with that. And maybe that's the media's fault partly, but...
So this is a frustration for you.
Absolutely.
Coming in as a young
Hugely
person.
Frustrating. I think,
yes.
I think it's frustrating for older people too, that
yeah.
it could be frustrated. But for whatever reason, the nature of global Christianity, it's these are issues which are divisive. And
sure.
if you are a national church with a global connection, it's going to make things difficult.
When you were at university, was there that debate?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's,
oh, okay. So we're talking about the church as it's established and working separately,
yes, I suppose,
from
in a parish, yeah.
the think tanks.
Yeah. My theological college, probably less so. I'm surprised by how little questioning of the big questions we did do at theological college.
Mm.
Definitely university, that sort of thing comes up all the time. I think it wouldn't be a university if it didn't. I mean,
quite.
It's the sort of thing
that's
which keeps students up drinking whiskey till ungodly hours and terrible hangovers.
Yeah.
So,
are we speaking from personal experience?
Absolutely, yes.
I won't ask that, Dan.
No, definitely. No, that's, again, young people have that. Universities about that freedom to ask those questions before, your own work. So that's
so. Would you say that coming from university into a practical job, as it were,
yeah.
that is the greatest challenge? Of having to accommodate.
Yeah, I loved coming to Dennington and being with people, because I was fed up with being cloistered away.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I wouldn't say that was a challenge, I mean, more of a joy, but it has had its own challenges.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to relate to a completely different set of people who, it's not just a group of undergraduates or graduate students, or even people preparing for the priesthood.
Yeah.
The whole spectrum of
yeah.
village life
yeah.
In Barford and Deddington. So, quite early on, you find yourself at the bedsides of those who are dying, for instance, and that's a completely different place to be.
Yes.
And there aren't obvious tools from the theological kit bag that you
right.
can bring out
right.
because it's. It's not about offering answers at that point. It's just about being present to the person.
So given this situation, where do you learn how to handle these things? Is it dependent on the people you meet in the village?
I suppose. And some of the people who have died since I have been here, they were ill when I arrived. So I accompanied them in a very small way.
Mm.
Visiting them
yeah.
prior to their death, and so you do get to know them, and there's a certain conversation which you've established. Other things, I suspect, are just down to the person, and I don't know how well I have managed those situations. It's your own experience in life too. I think it is absolutely terrifying. One of my first visits to the hospice. Was when the vicar was when he was ill, and and I was asked to say some prayers for this wonderful lady who was dying. And the family said, you know, do you mind if we join you? And then you know, there were 25 people around the bedside with me. And you've got to provide some symbolic act, really, which, well, by anointing the person and praying with them, I think, I suppose, people feel getting a priest to do that is... it's a marker, isn't it?
Yes.
So it's okay now for you
yes.
to go.
Yes.
And there's a huge amount of tension there in that space. And that, I mean, amazing. It was wonderful, a huge privilege to be there in that space and for that person who was wonderful and sorely missed, I think, by all in the village. But there's nothing which can really prepare you for that,
no.
Apart from sensitivity, really. And,
yes, and you just learn by doing it and being
yeah,
there.
I think so,
yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I could imagine that you build a picture of what ministry means through these experiences.
Absolutely, and that's far harder to quantify.
Yeah.
As a curate in the Church of England, there are all sorts of boxes you have to tick now. There's a very professionalised training system. I'm the first year of it, so
right.
I had to write evidence, my learning outcomes and things like this. It's very much like training to be a teacher or a nurse
yes.
or a doctor.
That's interesting.
And some of it, of course, can be quantified by ticking boxes. Yes, I've done my so many
yeah.
funerals or
yeah.
baptisms and so
yeah.
on. But some of it is actually spotting where God is present.
Yes.
And how you can be with God in that space and help God in that space.
Yes.
And I'm only beginning to get a sense of where God
yes.
is in certain
yes.
situations.
Yes.
And that's, I'm sure that, you know, that's a lifetime's journey for any Christian,
sure. yeah.
You know, to be able to see where God is at work and
yes.
that awareness. But that's you know, amazing to you see God at work.
Do you need quiet times to find that? Does your job allow you?
I think you need the space to reflect upon
what I mean, yeah.
those experiences,
yeah.
definitely. And we do have a very active prayer life in the church with
mm.
a lot of silence
mm.
too. We have 20 minutes
mm.
of silence each morning
mm.
Before morning prayer. And
right.
that's very valuable just to let things whirl around your head
yeah.
and to see which things keep coming back to you in your head and things you want to unpack a bit
yeah.
more
yeah.
and think about. And then that goes into your prayer life. And of course, because we're doing morning and evening prayer each day, you're hearing the words and from Scripture, which are the cries and laments of people throughout
yeah.
centuries.
Yeah.
So you are
yes.
drawn into a,
yeah.
a pattern of living
that's right.
through that engagement.
And all the transitions of human
yes,
life
exactly.
are encompassed
yeah.
in this, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, the Psalms especially are
yeah,
really important,
yeah.
as I'm sure they are for many people who are listening. Because they are the only parts of the Bible which are prayers, they're cries to God for you know, in thanksgiving or joy
mm.
or
mm.
how the bloody hell is this still happening? You know, it's kind
yes.
of
yes.
You know, how, it's very honest, very raw, and that
yes.
allows me certainly to find a space for
yeah.
what I'm feeling
yeah.
each day. It's really wonderful.
So at this point, do you feel now the student days are a different existence,
yes,
almost.
Definitely.
That this
yeah.
is spirituality in action, which you have to make
mm.
sense of yourself.
Yes, yeah, and
it must be quite tough sometimes, though, to really think, where am I going? What am I doing?
Yeah, yes. But on the other hand, I think if you do know where you're going and do know what you're thinking and where God is, then something has gone wrong. You know, there's a certain arrogance.
Yes.
If not idolatry,
yes.
if God is here, he's doing
yes.
this, and that's
yeah.
very dangerous.
So you're always living with uncertainty.
Absolutely, I think that's, well, aren't we all? I think
yeah.
that's part of the human condition.
Yes.
I think I often find I talk far too much without listening enough, and I suppose that's every young man has that problem. Or, you know, all the great ancient philosophers will, you know, complain about young men speaking too much and they should just listen to the wisdom of the elders, which is absolutely right. I think I don't do enough of that. But there's, you know, that's that time for silence.
On the other hand, you've got the very positive aspects that youth brings.
Yes, perhaps.
The enthusiasm, the joy.
Yeah.
The
and
have a go at anything.
Yeah, and you've got to bump into things and learn and be bruised and have those experiences.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So do you, may I ask you, do you see this as a calling or a career? How is that for you?
I think increasingly as a calling. I mean, it was one of those things which I couldn't get rid of in the back of my mind, and I thought I would be an academic. But the call to keep thinking about the priesthood kept coming back to me and needed exploring. I'm sure doctors will have similar experiences. There's a certain draw which you can't really put down to just a career desire. But up on a doubt, you know, even a year ago or 2 years ago, I would have been far more ambitious than I was now. You know, I'd have a kind of career strategy, which was quite academic based, I suppose. And that's sort of been blown to smithereens.
Has
it? Yeah, absolutely. I just lost all passion for rising through the ranks. Well, the more I see of the higher ranks, the less I want to rise to them. But which I shouldn't say that.
Okay, so
that might need to be edited. No, a lovely bishop. No, he's a great bishop.
So where is your passion now then?
I just don't know, really. I think that's, I mean, the passion, I suppose, is here and now, and the learning. Increasingly, I think it is for a deeper prayer life and to explore that side of things more than teaching or writing, even though that's it, I think I want to keep that going. But it's, you know, being here has opened up a new, opened up lots of doors for me spiritually, I suppose, and as a person, which have been very healthy. And yes, it'd be interesting to see where it goes, really.
Yes.
But it's probably not where I expected.
So
Exactly,
it?
Yeah. We were best laid plans and all that.
Yes, that's right. And the inspiration can come from all sorts of unexpected events.
Yes, exactly. And that's the gift of parish life. You're buffeted by lots of different experiences and different people, which make you think differently about the world. Yeah. So what's important?
Thinking of Daniel. You know, what are the things in your life that you find yourself doing no matter what, because they're you?
Yes. Yeah, it's very important to hold on to that sort of thing, isn't it?
What would they be?
A role like this. I think music, definitely. And and still do a bit of singing. In fact, I have a quick plug for the Vicars of Bodicus in Deddington and Beer Bath, and I are creating a CD for Christmas, so definitely raising money for various charities, so well worth buying. But that's, you know, singing, I think, is a good sort of primal activity, which I love, you know.
Yes.
And playing the piano. When I was ordained priest this year, parishioners and friends clubbed together to give me enough money for a piano. And that's been wonderful, having that at home, to kind of come back and play some Bach or something and just unwind and de-stress and let, you know, the thoughts are still happening, but it's just very helpful.
It's so useful. That's a really important part of your life.
Absolutely,
that really
is
a good balance for you.
Yeah,
I suppose, because I could imagine also that in the work that you do and the people you come across, there must be tremendous frustration sometimes that you can't do enough or you can't do this. And so to come home and play the piano and just lose yourself in the sound and the vibration of the sound.
Absolutely, all of that.
Physically good.
It is, yeah. And I'm singing to, I think that's what's been programmed on the TV about the value of singing in choirs.
Yes.
Gareth Malone.
Gareth, yes.
Yes, and people who have got stressful lives with a lot of anxiety. And these army wives, for instance, last night, I guess. I think, you know, the process of singing is your whole body and your mind. It's a very, even more so than the piano. You've got to breathe correctly and stand correctly. And amazing. I don't do enough of it, but
it is interesting, isn't it, when you think of the church and how the plain song started.
Absolutely. Expressing human desires
just
through singing.
Just the sound, and it sends shivers down your back, doesn't
even
it?
Now, and you know, we're very lucky to still have a choir here in the parish church. I'm a member of the North Cotswold Chamber Choir too, which I sometimes sing with. So.
So music is really
and listening to it and concerts,
you
know, that's
anything else that you know, no matter what, it's what you have to do.
I think increasingly walking and being outside, I think I only realised that's really something which feeds me as a person, and I've loved being out in the countryside for that reason, being near lots of great country pubs, which you can walk to on your day off.
And, yes, and then do some meditation exactly, over a pint of beer, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I've got some great friends who walk with me, so and they keep me grounded as well. So, I guess, yeah, singing. And, I mean, there's not an awful lot of spare time at the moment, no. So sleeping is quite valuable.
Yes, yes. You're a young man and you need to get... Yes. But I'm intrigued also, Daniel, just to go back a bit, is that when I look at all the things you've done and read and the reviews and so on, it's almost incredibly, I don't mean this negatively, but like esoteric things.
Yes,
not
yes,
the normal person, if you see what I mean, would come across.
No,
what intrigues you about what draws you to these things?
What's the passion for it? Yeah. Yes. Yes, I mean, my thesis was on the history of Oxford theology faculty, which sounds incredibly boring. what is theology as a subject is a question which has always intrigued me, because I'm going back to what I said earlier, what does it mean to talk about God? And what is meaningful language about God? And where does that happen? Mm. And a lot of people like Dawkins would say, well, theology shouldn't exist in a modern university. It's like the study of leprechauns.
Yes.
So it's not a valid, academic, rigorous science in the same way that mathematics or the social sciences are. You can't quantify what are the methods for talking about God who isn't visible in the same way that this table is visible.
Absolutely.
And that raises all sorts of questions of methodology and value. What is the meaning of a university and wisdom and knowledge? And that relates to sort of wider questions which fascinate me about secular Britain. What is the place of religion in that? I suppose that's the 19th century is the place where you learn.
I noticed
about that.
Yes. Why the 19th century, do you think?
I think that's probably the time where it became an option, a real sociably acceptable option to not believe.
Okay.
I mean, I suppose that was an option for a certain elite at the end of the 18th century, but you think of 1860, you've got Darwin's Origin of the Species has come out the previous year.
Science,
and
yes.
You've got a group of Oxford scholars saying the Bible isn't literally true and it's written by all these many different authors with lots of different agendas. It's like any other book.
Mm.
So you've got all these cherished notions of who God is and what Christianity is shattered quite dramatically.
Yes.
And I think we're still living with those tensions. Yeah. But, amazing, really, that Dawkins evokes the sort of debate he does even now. Anglicans had kind of resolved evolution and faith by the end of the 1880s, so or even earlier probably. So it's amazing that it still has this power to energise the public debate in the way it does. So they're very live questions. I think if you want to understand modern Britain, the 19th century is the place where
it's very interesting, where it all began in a way.
Yeah, we gather our identity and
Lots
of that shattered in the First World War, of course, but we still, I was thinking today about this love for Downton Abbey and even the Remembrance Day services and perhaps a sort of revival of the monarchy. There's a sort of nostalgia, if you like. I mean, Remembrance is something different, but there's a desire to go back to a time of certainty with regard to our national identity, which is pre-First World War, I suppose.
Yes.
And
but it may be a bit of a myth. It may just
be... I'm not sure, that they weren't happy times either. So, it is... But that's fascinating.
But is it a sort of search for kind of values and something to base your life on?
Perhaps not so much the 19th century, but... and even I'm not sure I'd even describe my love for God, whoever he is, as that so much a desire for values, though I guess some psychologists might say it is, I don't know. Where does the human desire for God come from? That's, again, debated in the 19th century. And Freud has his own ideas, as does other anthropologists and so on. So it's
is it just part of our makeup?
Yeah, or is it
to ask these questions?
Yes, exactly. I think yes. I mean, I think about death quite a lot, I suppose, and that's my friends always used to laugh at me, especially this time of the year when everything's dying around you. I spend a lot of time thinking about it, and maybe that is just part of the job. But I think I did that before I came here, and yes, meaning, I suppose, and asking those questions. I mean, the joy of my job is, and the things I've had the privilege of studying and thinking about is that can think about those questions of meaning. So that's something about meaning. Yeah. Meaning, value, it's all, all much the same, isn't it, I suppose?
I suppose by values, I was sort of thinking of a base for one's life, of how one lives.
Yes, yeah.
And
I think when I became a Christian, it was very much, here was a very rigorous set of values and a worldview which I could take immediately and it would solve everything. Yes. Especially, you know, as a teenager, you are you're changing so much, and I had a very complicated family, which meant there was a sort of stability within the Christianity which I grew up, a Christian I became as a 14-year-old, which was definitely about, well, probably less about the theology and more about what the theology gave me as a human being. And I suppose that's changed a lot since, you know, I've left a lot of that behind, and part of it's still with me, but at the same time, it doesn't function quite the same way.
No.
In fact, as a priest, you get, I think, well, fed up with religion and the role it plays in your life, and you just want to break free of it a lot of the time. Exactly, yeah. But God is still there, something distinct from
us. Of course.
I think God has become a lot more distinct from the religion, if you like.
I understand. Yeah. That can be just a very personal company that wherever you are. But to talk about it, to try and make sense of it with other people all the time, that's too much.
Yes, it can be.
You need a break.
You know, it's a huge transition from going from, I think parish life, where it bombards you all the time. Yes, I can become quite anti-religion, but on the whole, I'm pro-religion. I should add that.
one thing, we've just got a couple of minutes left, which I would love to ask you about, and it's in kind of practical, is that your experience in Palestine.
Oh, right,
Given what we've just been talking about, how did you put all that together?
Yes, religion, Palestine, Israel, all a bit of a mess, I suppose.
How old were you when you went?
I was 21, 22. But the war was up around Bethlehem, and you saw what these divisions were doing to people in their everyday lives. And, you know, it is very depressing to see how these ancient divisions are still such a powerful way of dividing up people. And there are no easy answers to that, obviously, and Christians behave just as badly as the others in Jerusalem, especially. It's very disheartening.
It's extraordinary that part of the world is the birthplace of so many of the religious thinking, if you like.
Yes, the Fertile Crescent, it's called.
What's it called?
The Fertile Crescent, it's kind of name. From Babylon, Syria, there's these ancient civilizations which clash.
Yes,
and Israel's a key trading, was always a key trading route from Africa to Asia. Yeah. So it's important for a whole variety of reasons.
So it makes sense,
indeed. That's recent. But I mean, walking into Jerusalem on a Friday night, the old city, I don't know whether you've done it.
I haven't.
I think I was there at Hanukkah, and it is something else. You've got Orthodox Jews piling in to go to the Wailing Wall, and Muslims going up to the Temple Mount or to the mosque there, and the tension in the air is electric.
Is it?
For all the wrong reasons. You know, they don't look at each other in the eye. It's even as they're passing by each other. I mean, it's amazing that
this is
how it will be resolved.
How can we have empathy that we have our own path, but we're all trying to do the same thing? Really, we have the same need.
I mean, talking to the kids about the Temple Mount. That very little bit of space in Jerusalem where David's temple once stood, and or Solomon's temple, and then the second temple before it was destroyed by the Romans, and then obviously very holy to Muslims because of Muhammad's dream of being taken there, and to Christians too. That's where Jesus was sentenced, and it's all, it's incredible that that little block of land can be the cause of so much distress and violence, even today.
But
there's no clear answer to it. No end in sight.
No,
there
isn't.
But yes.
So just to finish off then, so you're pursuing your career in Dellington for the sort of 2 or 3 years?
Yes, yeah, here for probably another couple of years. Yes,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
And is all that part of your training? And then you...
Yep.
And then what
then
happens?
I just apply for posts.
I see.
Yeah, at the back of the Church Times and see whatever comes up. So,
okay. So you won't at this stage know yet what you want to do?
No, and I'm glad I don't have to worry about it either. It's nice not to have to... You know, it's a lovely, wonderful place to be. With great people who are very supportive of my learning, among them, and I couldn't ask for more. Really, feel very privileged to be here, especially when I speak to other curates, people in my position around the diocese. I think it's one of the best places to train in the diocese. So,
oh, fantastic!
Well done, Dellington.
Yes, well, I would say that. Well done, Dellington.
Exactly,
that's very, very nice.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Dan, for
not
talking to me.
No,
it's
great.
Been very enjoyable. Thank you.
Great.
And
thanks.
All the very best for your rest of your time in Dellington.
Thank you. I look forward to it. Thank you.
Okay.
And that was Hilary Smith talking to Daniel Inman for Dellington Discussions on Dellington On Air.